old friends and people who are here for the first time. The schedule this afternoon, we'll begin, as usual, I'll give a talk for about 45 minutes, there'll be a short break, and then we'll have a meditation period for about 30 minutes, and then discussion, questions and answers after that until the questions run dry, and then that'll be the end. So, to begin with, before I became a monk, I once went to see a movie. Now, some of you, older generation like me, might remember this film called Cabaret. Anybody seen Cabaret? And there's a really memorable scene where you see this young boy, blonde hair, and he's singing in this really angelic voice. And it's a beautiful song. And you're just enjoying the sort of the purity and the angelicness of this young boy. And then the camera starts to draw away. And as it draws away, you begin to see the context. And this young boy is in the Hitler Youth, and it's in a beer garden. And all the people sitting around are all wearing Nazi uniforms. And suddenly something which had seemed so pure and so angelic all of a sudden becomes very sinister. And so the singing is the same singing, the boy is the same boy, but seeing it in a slightly different way and seeing it in a new context completely changes your whole feeling to what's being perceived. And this ties in with a modern term which many of you may be familiar with, the idea of framing and reframing. And political consultants, when they are giving their advice to politicians who are about to face very difficult and prickly questioners, will always try to drum into them this reframe the question. So you will probably have seen this when somebody asks this rather difficult and embarrassing question of the politician, and the politician says something like, "Yes, well, thank you for that point, but that's not really what I want to speak about. This is not what this is really about. You know, what we're really talking about here, what this is really about, is this, this, and this." That's called reframing. And the ability to reframe a question is one of the more important political skills. But in a more wholesome way, I think it's an important spiritual skill. And when I was first in Ubon, nearly 30 years ago, of course I didn't speak Thai very well at all. And it was noticeable, inspiring to the extent to which our teacher, Ajahn Chah, was able to frame quite subtle, profound points of Dhamma in very simple language that those of us who were just learning Thai and weren't at all proficient could understand and remember. And indeed, many of the short phrases that I heard in my first year here, you know, have stayed with me all the while. One of the phrases that Ajahn Chah would use was Tuk Prakit Pit. So Tuk means dukkha or suffering, Prak means because, and Kit Pit means wrong thinking. So he would be constantly pointing out that dukkha arises through wrong thinking. Or let's use my phrase from just a moment ago as like wrong framing. So if we compare physical and mental phenomena, particularly physical and mental suffering, I think there's an important distinction that we can see quite easily. If you, any of us, were to put our hands into a flame, to the fire, our hand would burn. And so whether you're a man or a woman, an Asian, a Caucasian, a Christian, a Buddhist, whatever, exactly the same thing would happen, because that's the nature of fire, the nature of the human body, for that to take place. But with mental suffering, there is something else going on. And we can see that because the same stimulus will have an unequal amount of suffering for different people. Those of you who visited people with terminal illnesses, let's say with cancer, for instance, and say people of the same age group, same kind of cancer, same level of cancer, and yet the subjective suffering of the two people can be widely different. So why should that be? There was an experiment conducted many years ago now, in which they compared a group of patients in an American private hospital and in a public hospital in Vietnam. And the American patients needed 17 times as much morphine as the Americans 17 times as much morphine as the Vietnamese, and still complained that they weren't getting enough pain relief. Now, that's not because Americans are soft and Vietnamese are tough, necessarily, but it's the framework. If you feel you have a right to be pain-free, and you're paying a lot of money for your medical care, then the slightest amount of physical pain becomes intolerable. Whereas if you're... Let's assume the case of many of the Vietnamese patients, where they're just grateful for whatever pain relief they get and don't have any great expectations that with an illness of this severity that they have any expectation to be pain-free, then they suffer a lot less. So when I said framing or reframing, I think it's necessary for us to recognize that we always experience things within a framework. It's not applying a frame, or it's recognizing the framework that we already are applying and seeing whether or not it's one which is conducive to freedom from suffering, or one which is compounding our suffering. So Ajahn Chah would constantly be pointing to the fact that strong desires, sensual desires, or desires for how things should be, for instance, make the mind rather rigid and insensitive to change and the way things are. And seeing things in terms of whether or not they measure up to what we want, or to the extent which they are free from the things that we fear, is applying a framework to experience which is destructive and which doesn't help us at all. So part of meditation, and particularly development of mindfulness in daily life, is learning how to step back from things and recognizing recognizing the what we're doing, you know, what part we're adding to experience. So it's not simply a matter of being present. There's a lot of sort of New Age talk about being in the present moment, as if that was a goal in itself. But it is one part of spiritual life, and it is a foundation for wisdom and for following the path towards liberation. But it's by no means the whole story. And sometime I was recently asked about by someone about their son who can spend hours in front of a video game, and asked whether you know that they were totally in the present moment, they're not interested in eating or sleeping or anything, and whether that meant they had good samadhi. You see, so I mean it's a good question, isn't it? I mean, if you're totally in the present with a video game, is that the same or different from what you're trying to do in meditation? And I think if you take the idea of mindfulness as being this kind of floating quality, meaning just being in the present moment, then it's hard to answer that question. But mindfulness in the Buddhist sense means not forgetting or not overlooking all the things that you need to remember, need to bear in mind in that particular situation. And that includes moral, ethical values as well. Now, one of the things that we hope to learn in the formal meditation practice is the ability to look within more clearly, more consistently, and over a longer period of time, not just the occasional flash of awareness or insight, but developing that steady presence of mind, what's going on within, what's arising, what's passing away. Now, one particular area of focus is whether or not the mind is in a wholesome or an unwholesome state. Now, this word wholesome and unwholesome always reminds me like Dr. Finlay's casebook in Scotland and porridge and things like that, but it's the best translation we have of kusala and akusala. So how do we explain this in more clearly? If we act and speak, think in a way which reduces the amount of greed, hatred, and delusion in our minds, or sustains or increases the non-greed, non-hate, non-delusion in our minds, then we call that kusala. So if we act, we speak, we think in ways which increase, strengthen the power of greed, hatred, and delusion, undermine, diminish the amount of non-greed, non-hatred, meaning loving kindness, compassion, non-delusion, wisdom, intelligence, then that would be akusala. So we need to be aware not just of what's going on in our mind, but being able to make this basic distinction of whether it's kusala or akusala. And you begin to develop the sensitivity when you've made this determination to look through that particular frame of kusala and akusala. You begin to notice that sometimes your mind feels bright and clean and flexible and malleable and wholesome, and sometimes the mind just feels kind of dirty, soiled, flawed, restless. And that's the akusala, or unwholesome mind state. So the particular actions, thoughts, speech which might stimulate or bring these kusala and akusala states into existence will vary a lot. But here we're very interested in looking at our inner experience through this framework of kusala and akusala. Because once you can do that, then this question about the boy or the girl looking at the video screen and zapping monsters and doing all these kinds of things, whether or not that's like samadhi, is easier to answer. Because for it to be the kind of mindfulness which is a condition for foundation, for the clarity and stability of mind which will allow true wisdom to function, then there has to be that wholesome attitude in the mind, that wholesome state. Now, one to give you a little bit more idea about these two states, the akusala mind state, the unwholesome mind state, is characterized by recklessness. That means an unwillingness, a disinterest in the consequences of one's actions. So this is kind of thought that we all have. You know, you're doing something, and then you think this isn't such a good thing to do, and you say, "Shut up!" You know, just don't get on my back. You know, you just don't want to think about that. Because if you think about that, you're afraid that you won't enjoy it so much. So it means that you're screening out certain aspects of the truth of the situation because you want to hold on to a certain feeling. So there's a censoring going on in the mind and a resistance, reluctance to consider the consequences of your actions to your own short-term, long-term welfare, or to that of those around you, family members, other people, the society which you live in, and so on. So the wholesome mind state is one which is not just in the present moment, but has that recognition of the consequences of actions as well. There's no resistance to that kind of thought at all. Quality in the unwholesome mind is a lack of what is a difficult word you see in English. We have this term shame, and shame is not a very kind of positive quality in English language these days. It's confused with guilt and but in Buddhist psychology, it's considered to be a very mature mental state. And it's the traditional analogy that's given is that one shrinks away from certain kinds of behavior with a sense of revulsion, in the same way that you would feel if you were encouraged to go to toilet in the middle of a marketplace, you know, in the public. You would feel that would be really too horribly embarrassing and shameful. And similarly, when you really understand the nature of unwholesome karma and bad karma, then you shrink away from it. So it's an emotion, but one which comes into existence and one which is supported, sustained by intelligence and through reflecting on the way things are. Now, just distinguish that from guilt. So guilt is considered to be an unwholesome mental state in Buddhism. Just as shame is a wholesome mental state, guilt is an unwholesome mental state. and it's based upon, founded upon a false sense of self. I should be a certain way. I should do this, I should do that, and I didn't. I didn't do that, and I should have done. So this idea about who you are or who you were, and what you should have been, and what you should have done, and what you didn't do, and what you, and so on. So it's considered to be a form of confusion, and mental agitation, and an obstacle to spiritual progress. Whereas a healthy sense of shame in Buddhist psychology is considered to be an ever-present quality in a wholesome mind, and comes into existence through wise reflection. So we're starting to look at experience and noticing whether there's this this sense of reluctance to consider the consequences of one's actions, or willingness to, the sense of intelligent shame, unintelligent indulgence, and the other salient characteristic of the unwholesome mind is it's restless, whereas the wholesome mind is a certain sense of contentment and restfulness within it. So these are things to bear in mind when you're first starting to look at your mind in this wholesome, unwholesome framework. Now this framework appears throughout the Buddha's teachings. And I'm reminded of a particular sutta in the Digha Nikaya, where the Buddha is asked, how do you decide, you know, should you associate with that group of people or not? Should you work in that kind of environment or not? Should you do this or not? Many, many, many questions. To which the Buddha gives more or less the same reply, is if the kusala dhammas in your heart increase and the akusala, the unwholesome, decrease, then it's appropriate for you to proceed or to associate with those people or to work in that particular place. If, on the other hand, you find that akusala dhammas increase and the kusala decreases, then it would be inappropriate. So that's the criteria for what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. So not taking some philosophical position or some ideal about who you should be, how you should be, how a spiritual person should be, how a good person should be, but taking the reality that you're starting off with and seeing the changes and the fluctuations in that, relating it to one's situation and to the one's own behavior, particularly in terms of body, speech, and mind. So the way that we frame things, particularly, as I'm saying, in terms of kusala and akusala, think very important, and one that can give a real sense of direction and groundedness in our daily life, and particularly in the difficult area of decision making. Apart from that, frameworks very much the means by which we see meaning or lack of meaning in experience, and that is vitally important for us. The Buddha gave great precedence to patient endurance, being able to peacefully coexist with the unpleasant when it's appropriate to do so. Now, if we look at our own ability to bear discomfort, I think we'll see that it varies a great deal according to circumstance. And it's interesting to look at why that should be so. Now, if you have to experience some discomfort or even physical pain for someone you love, it's not so difficult, I think, for any of you who are parents. If your child is sick, I'm sure every one of you have thought, if I could just take their sickness away and be sick instead of them, and to take this pain on myself, I would, without a second thought. So we do, under certain circumstances, particularly in presence of when we experience vicariously, we see the pain of someone we love, then we're willing to take on a great deal of discomfort. But in the case that we see suffering as pointless, then we find very little capacity to put up with that. Why should you? Why should you put up with that? It's pointless, it's meaningless. So the extent to which we see something as meaningful or not is a major conditioning factor in experience. And so in spiritual life, one of the things we're teaching ourselves is way to see meaningless activities as meaningless and to see meaningful activities as meaningful. So one of the verses in the Dhammapada, one of the most beautiful collections of Buddha's sayings, says the foolish person sees the inessential in the essential and the essential in the inessential, whereas the sage sees the inessential in the inessential and the essential in the essential. Which means that one of the reasons that we get caught up in inessential or ultimately destructive activities and habits is not just because of the immediate buzz or short-term pleasure that we might derive from it, but also we are seeing it within a framework in which it seems to give some meaning to our life. So when someone is incredibly obsessed with a certain kind of experience, then they're almost inevitably saddled with great fear of losing that experience. And part of that is because you feel the meaning of my life is bound up with that. So people who give great meaning to romantic love say, well, if I didn't have that person, if our relationship ended, then my life would be meaningless. You maybe think to some people even kill themselves, don't they, because of the breakup of relationship, or at least we can go into periods of depression and great subjective suffering. So it's not just because of the loss of that connection and that the pleasure and happiness, but it's because of the implications towards this understanding of who you are. So the greatest loss, the loss is most difficult for people to bear, is the loss of children, isn't it? And you say, like, if you lose a parent, then you lose the past. You lose one part of your past. But if you lose a child, you lose your future. So it's not just the loss itself, it's the implications on who you are, what your life means. So we're always one of the most important frameworks that we have, and one which we have to look at more closely, is this idea of who we are. What's our modern terminology? What's our self-image? Regards to this, something quite interesting I found is that in the Korean War, well over 90%, almost all American POWs collaborated with the Chinese captors. Whereas in the Second World War, which was only a few years previously, very few of them did. So how were the Chinese able to create that kind of compliance and collaboration? Well, they were very clever. What they did was they'd have these kind of meetings with the POWs, and they'd encourage them to own up to the fact that America is not perfect. Do you say your country is perfect? It's not perfect. I mean, so if you're not being threatened and reasonably kind of relaxed, and yes, okay, yes, America is not perfect. So you start off from this very small point, and then they say, well, you say America's not perfect, can you give me some examples? You see? Just one or two examples. And then give one or two examples. And then the next stage would be that they would be asked to write this down, the reasons that they consider America not perfect, and to sign it. And then after that, they would have like kind of meetings where people would have to read out what they'd written. And writing something and signing your name to it has incredible psychological effects. You can't just pretend it didn't happen anymore. You can't just lie to yourself or to anything. It's there. It's in black and white. It's got your name on it. And they go stage by stage, little by little, to the extent that they would ask them to write essays about it, maybe, give talks. And then these would be broadcast on radio to other POW camps, and even to American forces. Now, at this point, this person is now perceived as a collaborator. Now, when people perceive you as something, and when you've got into that position without any overt coercion, they had just gone step by step by step, very, very gradually, without any great force on them, then people that believe, yes, I am a collaborator because I have acted in these ways. So their self-image changes. And once they believe I'm a collaborator, then further acts and increasing acts of collaboration became just normal, because that's what collaborators do. So what I'm pointing to here is that the Chinese technique here was to change people's idea of who they were, just in but gradually, step by step by step. Because the way that we act, if we act in a particular way, a particular pattern, we start to adjust our idea of who we are to align with that. Another example of this was that these researchers had these big signs, really big ugly signs, encouraging people to drive carefully. And they went around and knocked on people's doors and said, would you mind if we put these in your front garden? So, and they showed these like photographs of what it would look like. I mean, totally ugly, and it would obscure the house. And so 80-something percent of people said no. But then they went to this other neighborhood, and 76% of the second neighborhood said yes, even though these built really ugly, spoil the whole look of your front garden. Why was that so? Because 3 weeks previously, there'd been people go around and give people these little 3-inch by 3-inch signs saying, please drive carefully, to put in their window. That was enough. Because by 3 weeks later, they've become, their self-image has just changed subtly to they are people who support people driving carefully. So to be consistent with their new self-image of people who worry about the standard of driving, they're willing to put up with these horrible signs in front of their houses. But what's a little bit more sinister was that they went to a third neighborhood, one which similarly had also received these 3-inch by 3-inch little stickers. And now they asked them to put up a sign which had, which was nothing to do with driving. It was about some other kind of project. And over 50% of people in this case also agreed to stick these signs in front of their houses. So that's really quite shocking in a way, that you can manipulate people to make commitments to do things which they maybe normally would not quite like to do, simply by asking them to do something which is not directly concerned with that, but which gives them a sense that they're acting consistently. So this need to be consistent and to have a consistent self-image or self-framing. So in Buddhism, when we meditate, we're trying to look very directly at the nature of the way things are. You know, not in terms of me, this person, with my personal history, with my personality, and so on and so forth, but just looking at the breath, looking at mental, physical sensations arising, passing away, mental sensations arising, passing away. Now we're trying to be with the way things are more and more, and we see the extent to which self-images and self, the way that we frame ourselves, are something that we add on to experience. It's not that we can stop doing that in daily life, and that necessarily it's a good thing to do so, but that we can be aware of that and to be more skillful. One of the important aspects of early training as a monk is to develop what we call samana sanya. That is to say, the perception or this frame of yourself as a monk. And we develop this more and more to the extent that certain things you don't even have to think about it. You don't do that. Why? Because that's not something that monks do. And that's considered to be a conscious framing and a way of looking at yourself on the conventional level, which encourages spiritual practice. So the more that we look, the more that we see, the more that this obsession with self and the belief in conventional labels and frames as being ultimate reality disappears. So the conventions remain as conventions, but you know convention as convention. It's not you don't want to be someone who has no conventions, no taboos or anything. You know, it's just, yeah, this is a convention, and you can make use of that skillfully. But you don't, you know, consider that's who you really are, because that's what Ajahn Chah was saying. This is tuk prakipit. And the more mindful you are, then in the way that I've suggested, particularly with this sense of kusala and akusala, maintaining the mind in a kusala, in a wholesome state, means that attitudes to self and others change by themselves, and to a great extent. There's very nice story. It's not actually a Buddhist story. This is a story about people in Africa, told by Jews in Russia. So I'll tell it in Thailand, and it's it's already work. Yeah, it's about these two friends, and one of them has this beautiful horse, and his friend really likes this horse, and he'd really like to have a horse, that horse. And he says, please give it. I can't give it to you. I'm sorry. I'll buy it. How much do you want for it? I'll give you any. No, I'm sorry. I'm not selling it under any circumstances. So his friend's disappointed, but he's still absolutely determined he's going to get this horse. So one day he dresses in rags and lays down by the side of the road through the desert, on the way back to the town in which they live. And he sees his friend riding his horse going by. And he's, oh, help me, help me, like this. And so his friend stops, of course, and gets off, and he says, "What? I'm so thirsty. I haven't drunk anything, eaten. I'm going to die. Please help me." So this man very kindly lifts this so-called beggar up onto the horse, and he's going to lead the horse into town. And of course, the moment he gets onto the horse, he sort of transforms. He says, "It's me," and sort of rides off a few yards and laughs at this. At this friend, you could say, and his friend just stands looking at him, and he says, "Just stop, just for 1 minute." And his friend stops because he sees there's no way he's going to catch up with him. He's on horseback. His friend's on the ground. He said, "What is it?" He says, "Look, okay, you've got my horse, and you can take my horse. But I have one. There's one thing I'd like to ask you, one favor." And he says, yeah, what's that? And he said, "Look, I don't want you to tell anybody exactly how you did this, how you tricked me. Because if you do, in future, when there are people genuinely dying by the side of the road, there may be people who won't pick them up because they'll think it's a trick. And maybe people will unnecessarily die." And of course, this being story, his friend is so impressed by the nobility of his friend, he feels ashamed, and he gets off his horse and goes back and gives it to him. But even if he didn't, I mean, the reason I like this story is because I think it's gives a very good idea of the nobility of minds, which are not completely falling into that rut of poor old me, and I've been tricked, and how dare you, and all the kinds of normal reactions, but a mind which is sufficiently clear and bright that it could think about people who may possibly in the future sometime suffer as a result of this. So that ability to see, in Buddhism we talk about seeing suffering. And that's not meaning seeing my suffering. You know, so, "Oh, I suffer so much. I've had such a hard time in my life." That means that, you know, you're investigating suffering in the Buddhist sense. Because as long as it's me and my suffering, that's not the noble truth of suffering. But the noble truth of suffering is a universal characteristic. And it's only the mind which is strong enough, stable enough, happy enough, to step back from that me and mine kind of maelstrom that can actually understand suffering. And then this is really the central irony or paradox of Buddhist teaching, is that only a happy mind can understand suffering. So the only way that you can really be free of suffering is you have to develop through giving, generosity, through precepts, through mindfulness, through concentration, that sense of stability, security, happiness, contentment, which allows you to look very clearly at suffering and its causes and let go of those causes. So that's the discourse for this afternoon. And now we have a short break if anybody wants to stretch their legs for a few minutes, and then we'll have a period of meditation.